Welcome to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy Faye Solomon, your host and producer. Delighted to be with you today on Wednesday, November 27th, the day before Thanksgiving, if you're in the United States. And you know, there's much to be grateful for today, especially if you're in the United States, if you're in the beautiful environments in California or anywhere, if you have much to eat, if you're gainfully employed, and if you can contribute to your fellow human beings. It's also, I have lots to be grateful for my health, for the opportunity to contribute to others, to educate people, and to excite people who are passionate about product excellence. So you're listening to the Global Product Management Talk. Please really reframe your circumstances to find the opportunity to be grateful for and thank everyone today. You can find us on blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk. If you follow us there, blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk, you will get pinged every time there is a new episode and a new program. And there's lots of exciting news that we are now expanding into the Global Product Management Talk channel with several programs weekly, including the Competitive Intel podcast that we're syndicating with Sean Campbell and Scott Weigart of CascadeInsights.com. Weekly, they bring us a 15-minute podcast on issues having to do with marketing insights, competitive intelligence, business analysts, and the whole other expanded area necessary to guaranteeing product excellence. Also, Brain Rants from Brain Mates Down Under is 15 minutes on a topical product management issue from an Australian perspective. And we'll be bringing on Product Powers with Bruce McCarthy from Boston from Up Up Labs, talking with product management experts and thought leaders, pretty much going back to our roots. So I'm Cindy Faye Solomon, and I bring you important issues having to do with product excellence, business process, product management, startups, marketing, innovation, and methodology for passionate product professionals and business owners about what it takes to produce successful products. We're brought to you this week by Startup Product Academy, forwarding product leaders with innovative approaches and experiential learning opportunities. Go to startupproduct.com and follow on @startupproduct for new blog posts, Startup Product Talks community worldwide, and Startup Product Talks in San Francisco, Oakland, and other areas in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as LA, Boston, New York, Singapore, Australia, and Colombia, South America, and the community grows. Thank you to the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, founded in 1998, promoting worldwide excellence in product management education with training, certification, and professional opportunities for corporate members, guaranteeing that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. They're on the web at www.aipmm.com. They have an excellent Friday webinar series, and follow them on Twitter @AIPMM. Sprintly, don't ask how it's going, watch how it's going with Sprint.ly, bringing the entire corporation to the software development process by showing managers and non-engineers a top-level view of what the programmers are doing. You can get 10% off your first 3 months at Sprint.ly. Use the code PRODMGMTTALK2013. We're coming to you live from Studio132.com with BZ Lewis, our 6-time Emmy-winning engineer and excellent musician. And the music is courtesy of Blame Sally. Check them out. They're an excellent local band. www.blamesally.com. Today, we are talking with Christopher Peel, who is a patent and intellectual property attorney, about the distinction between just getting a patent and having a patent strategy. The law governing patents and patenting is complex and changes often. The relationship of patents and other intellectual property assets to business strategy has evolved rapidly in the last decade or so. The costs involved in securing intellectual property assets are difficult to predict. As an intangible business asset, patents and other intellectual property assets can be difficult to manage. Nevertheless, patents are one of the best ways to protect new products and processes. The right patent can be worth millions of dollars to its owner, and patenting is an essential business activity for today's technology companies. So Christopher Peel is a founder and principal of the law office of Christopher Peel, and he spent most of his career in the San Francisco Bay Area, serving Silicon Valley as a patent practitioner for 14 years, representing all types of clients, from individual inventors and startups to major universities and Fortune 500 companies. He has a passion for helping people realize their business goals and their dreams, and he's fascinated by unusual technological niches. During his time as a corporate librarian in the biotech world, he got the opportunity to explore patenting and patent law and was attracted to the intellectual challenge it offered. Christopher was instrumental in securing a number of the assets, notably Cookie Technology and the AOL patent portfolio, recently sold to Microsoft Corporation for more than $1 billion. You can find him on the web at www.peellaw.com, that's PEILLAW.com, and on Twitter at patentfriendly, that's at PATENTFRIENDLY, and on LinkedIn at Christopher Peel, that's PEIL. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Hi. That was a wonderful introduction. You made me sound so great.
Oh, well, you are, of course. Oh,
thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Oh, and I left out that it was great. I first met Chris. We had an open house for Startup Product Academy last month during Innovation Week. And Chris came in. So do you live in the neighborhood of North Beach, San Francisco?
No, actually, I live in the Sunset. And then my office is in Hayes Valley. And I was just kind of walking around in that area because I never realized it, but there is so much technology going on in San Francisco, in that part of San Francisco. And so when I visited all these companies as part of that open house, they were all in that area, that sort of Jackson Square, North Beach area. And I was surprised. I had no idea that there was all that technology activity over there.
Well, I think that North Beach, particularly that area on Broadway, is definitely coming up.
It really
and,
is.
And, you know, I tell people I invest early, sometimes too early, but that there's definitely, it's been a seedy area. Mm-hmm. GPS sometimes tells people that they're at a strip club when they're not. But I definitely see it's a neighborhood in transition. It has a rich history. Broadway Studios itself is an exciting place. Mm-hmm. In transition, has a rich punk history, and I think it's totally appropriate because to be in startups, to bring something new that hasn't existed, it's totally aligned with a punk perspective.
Mm, for sure. And I think you told me when we first met that a month or so ago, that you had actually recognized this trend probably at least 7 or 8 years ago.
The trend at North Beach?
Trend in North Beach, right. Yeah, probably, I think you told me that you first saw this trend with all this technology moving into San Francisco and kind of settling in that part of the city probably back in 2005.
Well, you know, just a block over our, premier co-ops, and there's just a lot of transition. So you just follow where the building is happening and where the stealth startups are.
Right.
But it's still a secret, but it's exciting to be there and bring more technology in. And it's also interesting people's perspectives if they're from out of town. New Yorkers love it. The New Yorkers feel most at home it's still gritty, but it feels totally safe to me, and I have walked around at all hours of the night now, and across the street is that Tortoise Green Hostel, and there's also the Beat Museum across the street and around the corner.
That. So when I was over there the other day, I saw that, like the the green tortoise. Like, yes. The green tortoise has been around since the 70s.
Yeah, it's a hippie hostel.
It's a hippie tour bus, too. They drive all over the western United States, and they serve organic meals, and they camp and all that kind of stuff. I was amazed to see the green tortoise over there.
Yeah, so totally aligned with being scrappy and you know, operating with no resources. And there's people, it's very cool. If you just hang out, you probably have to pay to stay there, but in the lounge. And I stayed there overnight when we were doing the product boot camp last month.
You stayed at the Green Tortoise Hostel?
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Wow, really?
And people talking all different languages and all different ages. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. So definitely if people want to get a different perspective on San Francisco and the startup scene.
So we're at the bleeding edge then.
The bleeding edge.
Oh, great.
I like to
call
it the edge of the envelope, right?
Right, exactly. Good.
So getting into patents, and, you know, give us some context. Look, patents are totally important to product professionals, to developers, intellectual property. It's a whole issue of how much time do you spend, how much do you invest up front. You certainly want to protect your ideas, but even the question of, you know, is a business process an idea, is an incremental change. Just in the news this week, Apple was fighting, well, even more recently, there's a startup, Goldilocks, who builds toys for girls. And they use the Beastie Boys music video song about girls, and they repurposed it with their own words. So Beastie Boys sent them a letter saying, hey, this is cool. We totally support girls getting into STEM and science and playing with, you know, games, but it would have been nice if you asked us permission to use our song.
Right.
Well, Goldilocks, which is a woman-run startup, she went to Stanford, I think. She's getting a lot of media. Well, her response, probably from her lawyers or whoever, was an aggressive response suing Beastie Boys for, I don't know what, for some corporate, for some infringement of copyright. But so for me, I need you to really explain the difference between trademarks, copyrights, and is this part of the patent conversation? For me, I have it all under, these are the legal issues that I need to be concerned about in thinking about new products and in new intellectual ideas and properties.
That's really a good question, because what I find when I'm counseling clients and when I'm actually, you know, like just generally talking to people about patents and IP, even people that actually are fairly sophisticated sometimes don't really understand the difference between a copyright and a trademark and a patent and a trade secret. And so it's really good that we actually kind of like start out and kind of frame the conversation in this way so that we can actually kind of tease out those distinctions. And, you know, for example, we could start out with a patent, and everybody wants to know what a patent is, you know, and people think a lot about patents, and it's surprising because as a patent attorney, I'm always a hit at a party because everybody has an invention. Everybody has an invention that if I could just patent that. And so people think about it a lot. And so I guess we could start out with saying what a patent is. And actually a patent is a legal instrument that is actually granted by the government that conveys a right. And the right is, patent attorneys call it an exclusionary right, because it is a right to exclude someone else from making, using, or selling your patented invention. Now, that's really important, because a lot of people think that if they get a patent, the government is actually going to help them enforce their patent. And that actually isn't true. The government grants them a right to enforce their own patent. And the way people do that is that if they suspect that somebody is infringing their patent, they put the alleged infringer on notice by sending them a letter. It's called a demand letter, and they point out that they have this patent and that they think that they may be infringing the patent. And then they try to get the person to stop the infringing activities or to start paying them royalties on these infringing activities. And then if they can't do that, they actually can seek recourse through the courts. But the government doesn't enforce your patent for you. So that's really important.
How could the government? As a matter of fact, there's in San Jose, there's going to be, I think, a new patent office.
There is. They're opening a satellite office in San Jose, exactly.
But I think, again, the perception is that I'll be able to go down to the office in San Jose and get help enforcing my patent. But that's probably not what they're...
No, that's not what they do. That's not what they do. They actually issue patents. And actually, the process of getting a patent, we could actually talk about that a little bit if we have time today. Because in order to get a patent, first to somebody... That's another common misunderstanding people have about patents, that they just have to apply for the patent, sort of like applying for a driver's license, and that after paying a fee and after a certain period of time, they get a patent. And that isn't really the case at all. There is a patent application, and actually a patent application is a really pretty involved legal instrument. It is possible for somebody to draft their own patent application, but it probably isn't a good idea. Because it is such a complex legal instrument, it's probably better to hire a professional like me to do that. Then after the patent application is prepared, the patent application is filed, and then it actually just sits in the patent office for some indeterminate period of time. It kind of depends what technology it's in. For example, sometimes the patent office gets back to you like within a year after you've filed an application. Sometimes you have to wait 2 or 3 years after you've filed an application before you get a first action. Then when the patent office takes up your application, they examine the application because they actually have to determine that the invention that you're seeking patent protection for actually is novel and that it's non-obvious and that it's subject matter that actually qualifies for patent protection under the patent law. And now this whole process is really pretty rigorous. You know, there's a lot of negotiation and give and take between the patent office and the prosecution. Sometimes may take a year and a half or 2 years.
Wow.
And at the end of that time, after the patent office has satisfied that your invention meets all of the various tests that are laid down by the patent law, it actually issues a patent. So that process can take years.
Wow. And people cannot wait for that process to be complete to be forwarding their product or getting revenue.
Correct.
So now I understand. And then in the big companies, there's also a big game around who owns the most patents. And a couple of years ago, I remember looking at a map, and most of the patents were coming out of Silicon Valley, and I think they were owned at the time by IBM. I'm not sure who owns most of them now.
I would say so. I would say IBM is probably one of our most prolific innovating companies still.
Really?
Because
don't think of IBM as an innovator these days.
You don't think of them, but
30 years ago they were.
They have an enormous patent portfolio, and they probably, as a single entity, account for more issued patents than almost any other company in the United States.
Wow. And it also looks like that's a strategic play for Microsoft. We'll buy a company like a Motorola. Didn't they buy Motorola for their mobile patent or mobile intellectual property?
Exactly. That's another way of getting patents, is to just buy them.
But hoarding patents, how is that valuable?
Well, there's actually a question of whether it actually is valuable, because the patents a lot of large companies own all these patents that they're actually not using, that they're not practicing, that they're not working, and yet they have the expense of maintaining the patents. And so there's some question of whether it's really useful to just, you know, amass these huge war chests of patents. And of course, that leads us to the topic of patent trolls, because that's exactly what patent trolls do. Now, we don't actually, as patent attorneys, we don't like to really refer to them as patent trolls. We have a nicer term for it. We call them non-practicing entities. And they're people who own a lot of patents who don't practice the patents. But their business model is based on asserting those patents against people that they believe are infringing these patents. And then they try to get them to pay royalties and to license the patents, or else they take them to court and they try to sue them. And all of that is done to actually get these patents to generate revenue. And that whole process is called monetizing a patent.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So very interesting, because as you were talking, I was thinking of how people purchase domains in a similar way.
It's very much like domain names. It's like, yeah, exactly. It's like speculating in domain names. Yeah. I think the stakes are much higher with patents than with domain names.
Oh, for sure.
But of course, you know, like a really popular domain name can command a lot of money. I remember a company that I was working in, we actually bought a domain from somebody else. And at the time, it seemed like a lot of money. We paid $5,000 for it. But that was years ago, and I'm sure a really desirable domain name now sells for a lot more than that.
Right, and I find, because I'm always looking at domain names, if you look up who owns a domain name, you kind of get a sense of what their business model is, or what their thinking is, what their next plans are. And there is a whole bunch of, you know, once they see someone's looking for a domain name, they purchase it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would expect that that happens around patents too, because it's public, it's open publicly to see who's filing for patents, isn't it?
Not initially, no. At the very start, the patent is eventually the patent application is published. But until the patent application is published, the entire process is secret.
But don't you? Isn't it part of the process? And I'm exposing my ignorance here.
Mm-hmm.
that you have to do a search or to see if that patent already exists before you can apply for a new one, or am I confusing trademark process?
Well, actually, either with patents or trademarks, either one. Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea to do a search, because it would be really kind of like a waste of resources to file either a trademark registration or a patent application on an invention that had already been patented. But there's actually no requirement that you do that.
Ah, I see. So it's just, it's a good practice.
It's a good business practice. It will in the long run, it's going to save an enormous amount of money on money wasted on applications that can't ever mature into patents.
Ah, so we had planned on Q2. How are trade secrets and patents different?
Well, actually, a trade secret is another kind of intellectual property, but trade secrets basically are confidential information that only have value as long as they're kept secret. As soon as the information becomes general, then they lose their value. And companies, there's some really famous trade secrets that everybody knows about, like the 13 herbs and spices in Kentucky Fried Chicken and the formula for Coca-Cola. Those are really famous trade secrets, but a lot of...
They're famous because they're still secrets.
Well,
right?
We don't... Well, well, see, that's funny, because there are all these recipes out on the internet that claim
Mrs.
to...
Mrs. Fields cookies was big, Nordstrom's cookies or
well,
something.
Well, there are all these recipes that claim to have duplicated the 13 herbs and spices or that claim to have actually figured out the Coke recipe. And, of course, Coca-Cola just doesn't even comment on those, because as soon as they say, well, no, they don't have it or whatever, then they've they've undermined their trade secret protection. So they basically just ignore those and they don't comment on them. But just our product recipes are only one sort of trade secret. Like customer lists, for example, are important trade secrets. Business processes, very, very important trade secrets. Various types of know-how. And even in patented technologies, there can be trade secret aspects to those. There may be, for example, there may be a process, for example, that requires particular ideal conditions in order for the process to work the way it's supposed to. Maybe the conditions, there are ideal conditions. And perhaps the process itself is public domain knowledge, or it's public knowledge as a result of having been divulged in a patent, but the company has actually maintained as a trade secret exactly the type of conditions that allow this process to be maximally effective. So those are all trade secrets. And trade secrets are actually, they can be actually transferred and licensed and sold exactly the way patents can, or any other intellectual property items. So,
excellent. So I brought this up earlier, but let's address it going forward. So how are copyright and trademarks different from patents? And by the way, mm-hmm. I'm sitting here with Chris Peel. You're listening to the Global Product Management Talk. We're at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. You can follow us on Twitter at PRODMGMTTALK. And we have a Twitter chat discussion going on. But Chris is in the studio with me, and I'm being very rude because I'm looking at the tweets and I'm trying to tweet out some the great answers you're giving. But people need to listen to get all the great stuff. And so you can follow Chris also on Twitter at Patent Friendly. That's PatentFriendly. So sorry, Chris, for looking down and not.
That's okay. That's okay. Okay, we'll talk about a trademark. A trademark is another intellectual property right. It's actually, there are actually two levels of trademark right. There is actually a federally issued trademark registration, and then there under the common law there are also trademarks, trademark rights that a person acquires just by using a trademark. And a trademark actually uniquely identifies the source of a product or a service. And, you know, the trademark could be a word or a symbol or a device. It could be a design. There are even trademarks that are colors, sounds. For example, some of the sounds that are that you hear when you boot up the Windows operating system, for example, I believe those sounds are registered trademarks.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And again, they can, trademarks, registered trademarks, any kind of trademark actually, they can be transferred, they can be licensed, they can be sold, people can assert their rights against the trademark, against trademark infringers. They can the law gives them remedies against trademark infringers to stop a use of a trademark that they think they're entitled to. Then we can move on to copyright. And copyright protects expressions of ideas. One thing I should backtrack a little bit, because generally intellectual property always has to do with ideas. There are various manifestations of ideas. You know, when we're talking about patents, we're talking about inventions. And an invention, we like to think of an invention as an implementation of an idea. And copyright deals with an expression of an idea. And the expression could be a musical expression, it could be architecture, it could be a literary work, it could be the source code for a software invention. All of those are expressions that can be that are protected under copyright. And there are two types of copyright. There is a common law copyright, and then there's a federal copyright. And a common law copyright actually comes into being as soon as the work is fixed on a tangible medium, as soon as a song is recorded, or as soon as a literary work is actually written. The copyright automatically comes into being. And then in order to enforce that copyright, however, and take advantage of the remedies that the Federal Copyright Act provides, the copyright holder has to register their copyright with the Copyright Office. And again, a copyright is actually really a bundle of rights. It grants the holder of the copyright a number of things that they can do with this protected work, and the copyright itself can be licensed, it can be sold, and the copyright law gives the holder of the copyright remedies against infringers.
Awesome. Against infringers.
Infringers.
But
mm-hmm.
infringers.
Uh-huh.
But the onus for enforcing that protection is on the owner.
Always, always, yes. There is a little distinction with copyrights, because infringement of a copyright, not only is it a civil offense or a tortious offense, like something that they can be sued for, infringement of a federally registered copyright is actually a crime. And so with that one little exception, that is true. You know, enforcement of all these different IP rights, the onus is on the holder of the right to actually enforce their own right.
Falls to owner. Okay. So how does the patent cycle and the product cycle relate to each other?
Mm-hmm.
This is a big question.
It's a really big question.
Because for me, the product cycle goes through seven phases, but essentially it's mm-hmm. from the conception of it
mm-hmm.
before the production of it
mm-hmm.
and then the existence of it in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the patent cycle relate to that? And also, if the patent cycle takes so long
mm-hmm.
and we're talking about a product with really quick iteration cycles that's changing in the marketplace or changing revenue models or feature sets,
mm-hmm.
how do they line up?
Well, that's a good question, Answer. It's a big question, too. Well, I like to see it as the product cycle and the invention cycle or the patent cycle sort of like they follow parallel tracks. And conventionally, there are sort of separate silos in companies that don't really have a lot to do with each other. Typically, obviously, some exchange of information has taken place, but it usually is sort of just only at the executive level, and the information has to kind of percolate down the silo. There hasn't, until maybe the last 10 or 12 years, there hasn't been a lot of interaction between the practitioners that are actually doing the work involved at the various stages of the cycle. But actually, both the product cycle and the invention cycle start out at conception. And a lot of times the start of the product cycle and the invention cycle are really the same. There's an invention, and the invention actually may be the product, or maybe the invention may be a technology that's broader in scope than the product, and the product actually is maybe one embodiment of the invented technology. But they both start at conception, I'm sorry. They both do. And then a lot of what happens, the early phases of the product cycle, a lot of that is very, very much information gathering and studying and data gathering. And the types of data that are gathered at the early stage of the product cycle, ideally, in a perfect world, would actually inform the patent cycle so that better decisions can be made about what type of intellectual property would be desirable for for this particular product. Like now, I took this product cycle. I adapted this from a book called Patent Savvy for Managers by Kirk Teska. Now, Kirk Teska lists the stages of the product cycle as market studies, conception, design, manufacturing, testing, production, product release, sales and marketing, and then product improvement.
Which sounds appropriate for hardware. Mm-hmm. Hardware would follow that, mm-hmm. pharmaceuticals, things with long R&D mm-hmm. Processes.
Mm-hmm. So all of these, all this data that's gathered in the initial stages of the product cycle is really, really important for determining really how useful an invention that a company is considering patenting. Is it really worth the expense of and the trouble of actually going through the entire patent cycle, because it is very expensive. Typically, a patent, say on a software invention or perhaps on a medical device, a patent by the time you get an issued patent, the process of applying for that patent and actually getting the patent is going to cost tens of thousands of dollars. So it's an expensive process, and the more that you can inform the process with this data that's gathered in the formative stages of the product cycle, the better is the chance that you're going to come up with a patent that actually protects the revenue stream from the product, and advances the company's business objectives and does it as cost-effectively as possible.
Which is something that a product manager would need to be involved in or is often tasked with.
Well, absolutely. See, like I've known a lot of product managers. I've worked with a lot of product managers, so I've always known what they do. But at the same time, if I had to bottom line it and say, what is a product manager, I couldn't do that. You know, so after we got to know each other and we started talking about doing this interview, I actually looked it up, and I got some really information, some really interesting things about product management. Like this is a definition from a book called Inspired by Marty Kagan.
Right.
And he said, product management is the discovery of a product that is valuable, usable, and feasible. And
yeah.
Then there's another famous guy in product management. His name is Erickson.
Yes.
Erickson says you can define product management in a Venn diagram. It's the intersection between business, technology, and the user experience.
Right. So those are one aspect, and mm-hmm. so you know, product management is a function, business function.
Yes,
it's a discipline, mm-hmm. it's a profession, and those guys have perspectives from a technology mm-hmm. Point of view.
Right.
And then
mm-hmm.
you know, you were actually referencing in this book, Patent Savvy for Managers. There's the functional and strategic point of view that product managers have, but
mm-hmm.
And we tend to talk about. Products are anything that generates
mm-hmm.
revenue,
mm-hmm.
so a much even wider perspective
mm-hmm.
Related to patenting, because
mm-hmm.
that perspective is software-focused.
Mm-hmm. But the point is, though, that the product manager is really at the center of everything.
Well, yes. That is the key.
Yeah, the product manager.
No one else sees it that way, but
manager,
we certainly see it that way.
Product manager is at the center of everything. And so because of that, because the product manager has, is involved in so many different domains, they should really have an instrumental role in this patent
sure,
process,
right.
Because you know these are important assets that are designed to advance the company's business goals and protect enormous revenue streams. And because of that, the product manager who is so close to these products and has their hands on so many processes, you know, really needs to be involved in this.
Yes, and often the other thing is not only, you know, from a product manager's perspective, we're in the center and everything
yes.
falls out of it.
Mm-hmm.
From the business function, the product managers are really the only ones who are the facilitators or the guiders involved with the product from inception all the way out through all the phases it goes through.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes product managers, if they're technical product managers, they're coming in to forward the build, but after the inception, mm-hmm. after the research and development,
mm-hmm.
Too late.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, a strategic product manager would be involved in mm-hmm. in even bringing that idea in all of the aspects and
mm-hmm.
involved with the lawyers or the legal aspects mm-hmm. of it as well.
And then one question that you asked me for that I want to circle back for is because the patent cycle can take years, as I just said, and so a lot of times the patent cycle can be really out of sync with a product cycle. A product cycle can be really short, and so you're applying for patent protection on a product that has this very very kind of short product cycle, and then you're looking at not even getting an enforceable patent for years. And you know, by the time the patent issue, this product has morphed into something entirely different. And that is a problem. And we see it, of course, all the time with software-related inventions, because the development cycle for software inventions is so fast relative to the speed at which the patent cycle moves. And it's always been a problem. And the law is beginning to address that. There are all these programs now in the patent office. There are probably 3 or 4 different programs whereby you can actually accelerate the prosecution of a patent application. And one that has become very popular with my clients is called a Track 1 application. And you can actually pay a special fee to have a patent application receive prioritized application. And in some cases, it actually results in an issued patent in less than a year from the time that you apply for the patent patent.
Excellent.
So it's changing. It's changing. And so entities that are applying for patents now have some options. And actually, like this Track 1 application, if a company is a large entity, that's a company that has more than 500 people, the fee is quite expensive. It's $4,000 in order to actually place an application on this Track 1 prioritized examination. But at the same time, it actually can result in a significant cost savings because the prosecution of the application is so short that the expenses of prosecution are drastically reduced. And also, if you're thinking in terms of that, what you're trying to achieve with this patent, you're trying to protect a revenue stream of millions or tens of millions of dollars. So spending $4,000 to get a patent out the door all that much faster seems like a pretty good use of resources.
Now, who would make these decisions, or how would it be determined? You know, does the product manager work with the patent attorney? Who do you end up working with to educate the company about what is possible, the best avenue, or even what the strategy should be? Because certainly mm-hmm. product managers are responsible for the strategy of the product.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm seeing more and more they need to be educated
mm-hmm.
about patent strategy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the thinking of it. So mm-hmm. how, and let's see. So I think well, I want to skip to, I guess it would be our Q7, mm-hmm. which is how is getting a patent different from having a patent strategy? We've been mm-hmm. talking a lot about how to get a patent.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, still, in a lot of companies, in a lot of organizations, the whole process of patenting still is actually is fairly ad hoc. They develop a technology, or they have an idea for a new invention, and they say, "Oh, that's cool. Let's patent that." And then they go ahead and patent it. And then what happens is that they aggregate this portfolio of issued patents, some of which might be very useful to the company, and a lot of which might not be very useful. More and more, this is a trend that has started probably in the last 10 or 12 years. Companies more and more are actually adopting patent strategies, and including patent strategy actually in the product roadmap, and actually it's the process of actually really becoming very clear on the company's objectives and business goals, and determining exactly what is the company's competitive advantage, and then aligning the IP with what it takes to secure the competitive advantage and move the company's business objectives forward.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So actually including the whole patent process and strategy as part of the product roadmap. Again, in my thinking of product roadmaps, it would be on the front end.
Mm-hmm.
It's still part of the conception planning phase, but it has to, it almost needs to, the patent roadmap
mm-hmm.
needs to be parallel to the product roadmap. The strategy,
again.
The patent strategy roadmap,
mm-hmm.
it needs to coexist with the product roadmap. So it's one more thing that the product manager has to get on top of and get involved mm-hmm. with.
Absolutely. And typically, patent strategy it's been something that has been handled sort of like at the executive level, mostly by engineering and R&D and accounting and finance. And really, product management and marketing has never been really that involved in it.
But it really needs to be
kind of like thought about like at a more grassroots level, and it needs to be thought about like earlier in the product cycle. It needs to be actually thought about right along with the product cycle at the very start. And you know, there are actually a number of significant events that occur in the product cycle that one should always consider the IP implications. You know, always, you know, at the conception of a product, you always need to be really thinking about the patent implications and the IP implications of, you know, conception of the product. And then implementing new features, changing a product.
So every time the product changes, does a patent have to be addressed? Does it have to be tweaked?
Well, every time the product changes to the product create new opportunities for IP. Of course, the IP once a patent application is filed, there's really you're not allowed to change it, or else you can't take it back and say, well, we need to change the patent application because we've changed our product. But you can keep filing patent applications directed to that product that relate to all those product changes. So it creates opportunities as the product evolves and morphs into whatever it ends up as, it creates all these opportunities for additional IP. And so it's really important whenever a product undergoes a significant revision or new features are added to it, it's really important to always consider the IP implications. And another important event that happens in the product cycle that also has important IP implications is when new products and features are actually announced publicly. That is very, very important because a lot of these actions that are taken by companies can actually affect their patent rights. If, for example, an announcement of a new product or a new feature in a product is made prematurely, it can adversely affect the company's rights to apply for patent protection on that improvement, for example.
So that explains a lot of the secrecy in Silicon Valley. But there's a different perspective in startups, is this openness, transparency. Now, is that because changing a mobile application is not a patent opportunity?
But it is. It is a patent opportunity. It is absolutely a patent opportunity. When you change an application and you add a new functionality to it, for example, that is an important opportunity.
So how do you feel about then there's a lot of missed opportunities happening in startups. How do you feel about this open transparency that supposedly exists in Silicon Valley for startups and new ideas?
That's really a good question because there's really a tension between that. But on the one hand, openness and transparency and sharing technology and owning it on the other hand. There's a real tension between that. But I think there's a middle way. You can find a middle way through that because there are all these, for example, when you are making changes to a product and you want to go public with those in the interest of being open and promoting your company and your product, there are applications, we call them provisional applications that can be filed right away in the patent office. Like if somebody calls me in the morning, I can actually have a provisional application filed for them in the patent office by mid-afternoon.
Wow. But I thought it takes a long time.
Well, the provisional application is like a placeholder application.
Got it.
Eventually, you have to actually replace that provisional application with a full utility patent application. But in the meantime, just to secure your rights, to actually secure your priority date for that improvement so that you actually can go ahead and announce it and issue a press release about it or talk about it at a meeting or something like that, you can get that provisional application filed in there and you lock in the priority date on that technology.
Got it. Wow. With so much to learn, the product manager, I don't often hear this discussion around product management. This, you know, now a lot of startup lawyers that are talking about these issues, but I don't know how much they know or how much experience they have going through the process. I much prefer to work with someone who's worked with big companies to advise startups to understand. So I really appreciate.
Well, that's why I want to work with you, and I want to actually have a unit in your program so that your students can actually find out about these issues because there are issues that marketing and product management have not typically been involved in the past.
Right.
They actually have to, this information has to sort of percolate down to them from the executive level, you know, like, and that, the patent world, it has to percolate up to the executive level, and then it has to be communicated here, and then it has to percolate down to the product managers.
And there's definitely, since engineers and so much of our startups in this area mm-hmm. are technology driven. Mm-hmm. There's, look, lawyers talk a very different language than engineers.
We do.
Talk their
we
own
do.
Language. Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely there was, even at the beginning of the web, when I was involved in doing big web development initiatives, the lawyers were the ones who said, no, you can't do that. No, you can't put that public. No. It was perceived that you want to get around legal. Mm-hmm. They're not our friends. They're not going to forward what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So try and get something out there before they hold us back.
Well, if you call the lawyer early, the lawyer can actually help you have almost everything that you want, so that you can have that early press release, you can have that transparency, and you can have that openness, and you've still protected your rights. And it's fast, it's inexpensive, you know.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, we're definitely going to have a meetup where you talk at length, and we should do a whole series of how startup people, product managers, in the product team needs to understand this whole process, mm-hmm. but also the idea that it can be affordable upfront. And that's the other thing, that anything involved with legal is going to be expensive. And for scrappy, lean startups, that is not in the budget.
No, that's true, and that is a problem because, as you say, anything legal is expensive for sure. But there are law firms that really like to work with startups. They really like the energy and the passion, and they like being in on the ground floor, and they understand the limitations that startups have to work with, and they have flexible billing arrangements. A lot of times it's very common to have deferred billing arrangements. So perhaps they have to upfront, they may have to pay 50% of the fee, but they're allowed to defer payment of the remainder of the fee for a period of time, perhaps until a particular event happens, perhaps until they're allowed to defer their fee until they're funded, for example, or until an equity event takes place.
Well, excellent. So you've heard it here first. I've been talking mm-hmm. with Christopher Peel of Christopher Peel Law Office at 555 Fulton Street, Suite 108 in San Francisco. You can call him on the phone at 415-896-4254. He's going to be involved with Startup Product Academy, providing an education as part of the other services that are involved, that are available for startup product managers and product team members. So we're very excited. Come over to Startup Product Academy in San Francisco. We're at startupproduct.com. And have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks for joining us here, Chris. Very excited to expand upon this knowledge, make it available, and provide this education for product people and startup people to protect their rights and to forward their product excellence. So thanks for joining us here at Studio 132. Thanks for listening today. Coming up later on today, if you're following blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, and actually go there and do a follow, because we have a Brain Rant show coming up later today, and our competitive intel. There was a new show that came on last night, and we will have new global product management talk shows before the end of the year. This is Cindy Faye Solomon. You can also follow me at Cindy F. Solomon on Twitter. Thanks for being with us, and send a donation out to our colleagues in the Philippines, and make sure everyone gets something to eat tomorrow. Thanks, Chris, for being here.
Thank you.
And look forward to working with you more. Thanks, BZ Lewis in Studio 132. and have a great holiday and a great week.
On a dry winter leaf, I wouldn't know love if you found me.